How you's doing?
Fine. Just setting up.
When you said start, I thought you were going to say spreading the news.
Start spreading the news.
We're recording today. Dr. Bill will be a part of it.
I'm Captain Benjamin Sisko. Welcome to Deep Space Nine.
Red alert! All crew members report to battle stations.
Red alert. Shields up.
What shields?
You're Starfleet officers! Now start acting like it!
Oh, it's just Garak. Plain, simple, Garak.
Dax, we might have just discovered the first stable wormhole known to exist.
The wormhole does bring them our way, doesn't it?
Everyone wants a piece of the new frontier.
This will shortly become a leading center of commerce and of scientific exploration. And for Starfleet, one of our most important posts.
Quite a motley crew you've assembled here, Benji.
Listen to the Prophets, a Deep Space Nine podcast.
And here are your hosts, Andrew Leyland, Paul Spataro, and Dr. Bill Robinson.
Bloody hell. Hello, everybody, and welcome to Listen to the Prophets, a Deep Space Nine review program, where I, Paul Spataro, am joined regularly by my two buddies, Sir Andrew Leyland.
Hello.
And Dr. Bill Robinson.
Hola. Hey, everybody.
Hi, everybody.
Hey, Dr. Nick.
I love Dr. Nick. But this is not a Simpsons show, and we are not reviewing an episode with Dr. Nick in it. This is Season 4, Episode 12. Boy, we're up to Episode 12 already. I didn't realize we were that far into it.
Halfway through the season, nearly.
Well, that's because you just posted Episode 2.
I really didn't realize we were that far into it. Anyway, this is Season 4, Episode 12, Paradise Lost, which is the second of a two-part episode. Directed by Riza Badil, and the story by Ronald Moore, Andy's friend.
Yay!
Okay, but we'll talk about that in just a few minutes. But in the meanwhile, do we have any Star Trek things to discuss?
The pilot for the new show hits Netflix, and I think it's September 25th.
So that will be way in the rearview mirror by the time this shows up on the internets.
So you don't, that's right, you don't have CBS. That's right, you're going to get it on Netflix, and we get squat.
Yeah.
I just think I'm going to watch it on BBC America. Because isn't that the only thing you guys get over there?
Apparently, yeah. BBC don't even show Star Trek over here. I don't understand this at all.
And yet BBC America shows Star Trek The Next Generation all the time. I guess their thought is, well, Patrick Stewart is English, we can show it.
Well, Patrick Stewart is in it, therefore it's classy.
Patrick Stewart, who plays a Frenchman.
What's up with that? I really never understood that.
Le Patrick Stewart is in it.
Le Patrick
Stewart. Le Meow.
Le Meow. They would have been better off getting Pepe Le Pew.
Yeah, but then Riker would never get the woman.
Every episode would be him going over to Troy and kind of bending her over and trying to kiss her.
Mon chéri, my little buttercup.
I surrender.
And she's trying to run.
Le meow. What would Pepe Le Pew do with Deanna Troy's chest?
I don't know, but I would like to. I'll be willing to watch that one.
And then he'll start hitting on Beverly.
Don't think I have forgotten you.
My little firebrand.
That red hair, she is no lie.
And then Dr. Pulaski. Like...
Oh my god,
he goes over to Pulaski, he just turns around and walks away.
Mon Dieu, oh!
And then he tries it on with Romulan Tasha Yar.
Oh, God. The shoulder pads.
You with the little page boy haircut. Oh, la la.
Steals Vash.
We know what I think of Vash. I've gone on the record.
I got a rash from Vash.
That would explain a great many things.
We would so not I'm... surrender. Wait, I am French. Never mind.
Oh. Hey, French resistance.
Hello, hello.
Oh, God, did you get hello, hello?
Yeah, it was on PBS every now and then.
Oh, dear me. Not one of our all-time classic sitcoms.
It was on. I've never watched it. I do remember seeing it, like, in the TV guide and stuff.
The Fall of Madonna with the Big Boobies.
Is that what that was? I don't even know. Like I said, never watched it. I could never understand, you know, I should have taken British in as my second language in school.
But anyway...
Thank God for closed captioning.
Didn't we just have this discussion with Scott? Yes.
Yeah. Well, about hello, hello?
About stereotypes.
Yes, about Bob's your uncle. And he's like, I actually heard somebody say that. What does that mean? And I had to explain to them what Bob's your uncle means.
And Fanny's your aunt.
Oh, nah, I don't know what that means.
It normally follows Bob's your uncle and Fanny's your aunt. It's just, it's a continuation of the same thing.
Because that was worth having a sequel.
Yeah. But if we can sequel Jaws, we can sequel ridiculous sayings.
We had a whole discussion about, you know, the stereotypes. So we were saying, like, when you came over, you should have been wearing, like, a derby and a tuxedo.
And a monocle.
And a monocle. I think I did say a monocle as well. And you know, everything out of your mouth should have been pip-pip and, you know, either that or he said you could come as a chimney sweep and just sing all the time. And then...
That was Scott, not me.
Chim-chiminy-chim-chim-chiroo.
John Pakula came also, and he was saying, like, he should have come in a Dutch boy outfit. Like Buster Brown.
Oh, dear.
Am I dating myself with that? Do people even know who Buster Brown is anymore?
I do.
I only know him from what's his name. I only know because he mentions back down to your Buster Browns in Jaws, doesn't he?
Yeah, I think he does.
That's all I know it from.
Okay, well, this is not a Buster Brown podcast. Anyway...
Oh, what
so
was it?
We're covering... What?
No, I just remembered that Scott said, like, yeah, doesn't he have a dike to stick his finger in somewhere to keep it from leaking?
What? No, I think we said he's got such disregard for our ways that if there was a leak in the dike, he probably wouldn't even stick his finger in it. That was fun, to insult cultures as much as we could.
So anti-federation it is of us. So anyway,
unless anybody has anything else, we'll get back to Paradise Lost.
I don't think there's any...
I can see Paradise Lost by Federation's light. I don't think that's scanned.
Scanned?
It didn't fit in with the words proper, the lyrics properly, and the music. Ah. It wasn't one of Bill's better ones.
I didn't sing it.
Boy, you just sang it and you're blaming it on Bill.
Yeah, I'm blaming it on Bill.
You've taken what I do to a new level.
Bill would have gone there.
If you had waited long enough, Bill would have sang it.
Actually, I was trying to formulate something in my head, but Andy beat me to it badly.
So what you're saying is he's right.
He's right, but he's wrong.
How does that work, man?
If making fun of Bill is wrong, I don't want to be right.
I don't either, no. But I do want to be right about this episode of Deep Space Nine.
Do a synopsis, will you?
Synopsis. So, this is, again, Season 4, Episode 12. And it guest stars Brock Peters as Joseph Sisko, Robert Foxworth as Layton, Herschel Sparber as Jarris Inyo, Susan Gibney as Benteen.
Wow.
I understand that 3 out of 4 dentists recommend Benteen. David Drew Gallagher as Riley Shepard and Aaron Eisenberg as Nog. I almost feel like Nog shouldn't be listed as a guest because he's still part of the, he's pretty much a regular.
Hmm. Wasn't Benteen that cartoon about that kid with the watch?
Benteen.
Oh, sorry.
And when they made it,
you and your extra you and your extra vowels. I swear.
Yeah, there should be an extra U in the that tune.
First time they made it into live action, Lee Majors played the grandfather.
He did. That's very true.
So, Paradise Lost.
When the changelings reach Earth,
my duty is to protect the Federation.
That's what we're trying to do. Suspicion is everywhere.
With those troops in place, Admiral Layton controls Earth.
And war is imminent. But the real threat...
You think that one Starfleet ship is going to fire on another?
...is closer to home.
They've been told everyone on the Defiant has been replaced
by shapeshifters. On the next Star Trek Deep Space Nine.
Earth has been placed under martial law due to a seemingly imminent Dominion invasion, but Benjamin Sisko believes that there is more going on than meets the eye. With the aid of Cadet Nog and Odo, Sisko gathers evidence Layton is planning a coup and goes to President Jarish Inyo. Politics and lack of definitive evidence undermine Sisko's efforts. Around this time, Sisko is confronted by a changeling in the guise of Chief O'Brien. He tells Sisko that there are actually only a total of 4 changelings on Earth, and mockingly points out to Sisko how much panic they have caused, drastically out of proportion to their actual numbers. The changeling then walks away. Admiral Layton, the suspected ringleader of the conspiracy, has Sisko framed as being a changeling. Odo breaks Sisko out of prison. Contact with the Defiant is made, and it is learned that Layton's reach even extends to the station. A Starfleet officer on DS9 has affected the wormhole, creating the impression of a cloaked Dominion fleet entering the Alpha Quadrant and starting the entire crisis. Unfortunately, Layton has convinced the USS Lakota that the Defiant is crewed by changelings, and the two ships are forced into battle. Sisko confronts Layton at Phaser Point. The conspiracy falls apart when the DS9 conspirator confesses, and the captain of the Lakota refuses orders to destroy the Defiant to prevent evidence against the conspiracy from reaching Earth. Layton resigns. That's a slightly oversimplistic synopsis of the plot. It kind of hits the points, but it just kind of leaves it... I mean, it's just ending with Layton resigns. It just seems like a little, you know, there should be a little bit more there. I enjoyed this episode. I thought it was an effective follow-up to the previous, the part one. But it did lack a little something, and I don't know that the regular criticism is the same as what I'm thinking, because I was looking on, you know, the various sources, and they were saying how this was originally intended to be the season 4 opener, and that the previous episode was going to be the cliffhanger for season 3. And then they were complaining afterwards that there were problems with the episode because they did that, because the budget for a mid-season episode is apparently not as high as the, you know, the premiere, season premiere and season ender. And they were putting the blame on budget constraints, and I guess they would have added some more special effects in there and made it a little bit more spectacular. But my biggest problem with it is... they focused so much on the conspiracy that Layton created that they started to ignore the underlying issue of what's going on with the changelings. There were still 4 changelings on Earth. They were causing problems. And it was like, well, that doesn't matter because there's only 4 of them. And that's the thing that kind of bothered me a little bit is, yes, Layton caused an overreaction. And yes, Layton made things nuts that shouldn't have been. But it isn't like, okay, all is well now. And that's kind of the way the episode seemed to treat it to me. I don't know if you guys felt a little differently about that, but that's kind of how, you know, kind of the problem I had with it, even though I enjoyed it overall.
By and large, I agree with you. I think it was perfectly okay, but it seemed like all the interesting subtleties of what it was asking and the point of the story that were in the first episode were largely missing from part two, where it just became a rather standard let's hunt out the conspirators. Because I don't know whether Robert Foxworth telegraphed it, but it's obvious that his character was the bad guy.
It was telegraphed that Robert Foxworth was the bad guy when Robert Foxworth walked down to the
well,
street.
Yeah. But
at least for me, because everything I've ever seen him in,
he was the
he's
bad
always
guy.
The guy that could, because wasn't he the bad guy in like one of the airport movies, with the one where the plane splashes in the water and sinks under the water? Wasn't he the pilot that was like smuggling like probably paintings or something? Yeah, so yeah, like he's always the bad guy. So I'm like, something's fishy here.
I wanted a little bit more subtlety in either the writing of him or the performance that he gave. In the one of the things that was interesting about part one that we did discuss quite a lot was that he wasn't a bad guy in what he was actually doing. There was some interesting questions to be asked there about, well, how do we maintain utopia, the Star Trek version of the future that we've got, and what lengths do we have to go to, and that whole issue of what are you willing to do for the security of your people, for freedom, how many freedoms are you willing to give up, and all of that. All of that was interesting stuff in part one, and it was all raised,
got swept under the rug.
Yeah, and for part two, yeah, they didn't do anything with that. He became a mustache twirling bad guy in part two. And the only thing I really liked about part two from a story point of view, although the episode is reasonably enjoyable, was Susan Gibney's character, Ben 10, realizing that he didn't explicitly order her to fire, and therefore he was essentially throwing her under the bus. And he can say, hey, I didn't ask her to do that. And when she realized that, she basically said, right, well, no, I'm not doing this then. That was good, and I would have liked to have seen more of her than Robert Foxworth being all evil and smarmy.
They didn't address, and I don't mean to prevent you from giving your thoughts, Bill, I'm sorry, I'm going to step back in a moment, but they didn't address the fact of the underlying problem. So, okay, he created a conspiracy theory that caused them to go into martial law, which was an overreaction. But now, they didn't hit on the fact from the president's perspective, okay, once this conspiracy was unearthed, what do you do now? Because if you totally pull back on the martial law and these four changelings cause havoc, which they are certainly capable of doing, now you got a problem that you didn't properly vet things and make sure that they weren't able to do it. On the other hand, if you continue martial law, then you've basically stalled life on Earth for everybody in the meanwhile. So, you know, he was basically in a no-win position, you know, the Kobayashi Maru on Earth there. And they didn't really address that. There's some real political intrigue that could have been had with that, I think, you know, with some effective writing.
Well, one thing, Leighton, in the first episode, you could say, was kind of, he was concerned about Earth, but I think at the same time he was feeling out Sisko to see if he could get him to come on board as a conspirator as well. And also another thing that I thought that was a little strange, like right out of the gate, Sisko's father is now on board with the testing and he's okay and fine with everything, and it's like he now has a whole different it was like he changed characters, and Sisko brings it up to him, and he's like, well, I thought you'd be, well, you know, they had that discussion where he says, I thought you'd be glad that I'm on board. But, I mean, it kind of shows how even Sisko's father, you know, well, oh my God, well, the Dominion might, you know, how everybody's idea has changed, and everybody seems to be accepting the martial law. You know, I mean, what did you guys think of that, the way that Sisko's dad kind of changed from one episode to the other? It was all for it now.
I thought it was out of character.
Okay.
And this is a character we haven't seen very much of, but the way he was so outraged in the last episode, for
yeah,
him to
I
just
mean,
be totally accepting of it now, it's almost like a pod person took him over.
Yeah.
And my dog agrees.
Dog sneezed in agreement.
Yeah, that's what I was saying about part two just seems to sweep all that interesting stuff that they could have talked about and could have addressed under the rug, in favor of just doing a rather obvious he's a conspirator and we know he's not going to win episode. And it seemed to me there's an awful lot of scenes in this one of just Sisko and Leighton talking to each other, and that could be what Paul was mentioning about there wasn't the budget for them to do what they wanted to. But Star Trek sometimes excels when it has to do episodes where it's just people talking to each other.
Well, speaking of people talking to each other, when okay, I'm going to read this quote. This is between Nog and Sisko. When he asks him about the members of Red Squad, and Nog says the names of Red Squad members are supposed to be secret, but you know who they are. It's not easy keeping secrets from a Ferengi, but I feel funny about telling anyone else. Besides, if they found out I told you who they were, I'd never get in. And then he suddenly changes, and it's like, Cadet, you are obviously under the mistaken impression that I am asking a favor. I want a name, and I want it now, and that is an order. Understand, Mr. Nog? Yes, sir. Now, where did they have this discussion?
He mentioned Red Squad in part one.
No. Where did they physically have this discussion at? And this is my point.
Isn't it at Starfleet headquarters?
No, it's in a restaurant.
Oh, so it is. Yeah, you're absolutely right. In a public place.
Public place. And he talks and he starts berating Nog while there's behind him. Because they're sitting in the restaurant. Because remember, he was originally talking to his dad. Nog walks in. The dad gets up to go chill the tube grubs. Nog sits down, and they're surrounded by Starfleet officers.
Was that wrong?
Yeah, it's wrong.
Yes.
You're not supposed to discuss top secret military things in public like that. I was never in the military. I don't know.
Yes, it's wrong.
Especially seeing how Sisko's entire plan relies on him bluffing his way through knowing stuff that he doesn't actually know.
Yes, because that's in the next scene when I believe it's Cadet Riley walks in and he just tricks the guy into just unloading the whole thing that they did with the power relays. You know, like they were the ones that actually sabotaged the grid. And, you know, I was told there wouldn't be a written record. Don't tell me. You're telling me I'm wrong, Cadet? Blah, 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 blah.
I did like Sisko turn into Bane. That was the best part of the episode. I did like that scene in and of itself where Sisko bluffs, essentially, that kid.
Bluffs and browbeats a kid.
Yeah. It's, well, you know, you've got to do what you've got to do, man.
Well, yeah. I mean, he gets a kid to spill the beans completely.
I want a complete rundown of your entire operation from the start to finish.
That is his cadence when he talks.
1947 hours. Do you understand, Cadet?
Oh, damn. Of course, if I was faced with some guy in my face doing that, I'd probably spill the beans too. Okay, all right. Just sit down and go back off, man.
Oh, if I were in the military, you would never tell me a secret. I would crack so easily.
I give up. I just asked your name, dude. Oh, sorry.
You know, I do take criticism to heart. And we talked about that one iTunes review where the guy said, "Boy, it seems like they don't even like the show." And I know that, you know, we're hitting on this one kind of hard for its lack of subtlety. I think is probably my best way to say it quickly.
Yeah, because that the other
said,
one,
I enjoyed it. Otherwise, this was an enjoyable episode to watch. It's just the problem I had with it is that it comes off as a one part episode, a one and done. You know, or a one and done story, even if you count the first part of it, you know, the week before. It doesn't take into account that this is an ongoing problem that they have. It's almost like, you know, okay, we've uncovered Leighton's conspiracy, so now all is well in the universe. No. The underlying problem still exists, and that's the problem I have with it. And they just ignore that the underlying problem exists.
Yeah, there are still changelings on Earth doing whatever the hell they want to do, and they've not really found an effective way of screening for them.
Clearly quite happy with themselves from the way the O'Brien changeling acts.
Yeah, and I think the reason we're being a little bit hard on this one is the first one, in addition to having a lot of substance to the story that it was telling, and we got a lot of mileage out of discussing the points raised in that show, it did feel like the first part was very much open for challenging and looking exactly at what it would take to have this utopian society that Star Trek professes to be and how you maintain it. And it looked like it was going to poke a few holes in that and explain it and maybe come up with logistical reasons for how it works, why it works, what are we willing to do for it. And then the second part just kind of threw all that away and didn't do anything interesting with it.
Yeah, I agree. Not to overstate it, because it's not that they didn't do anything interesting. They just didn't take it to the next level, which is what we've come to expect from Star Trek.
Mm.
You know, they usually give you the, you know, the last episode was very thought-provoking. I mean, that question of how much will you give up freedom-wise for security? You know, that's a big question, and it turned out to be, you know, very, very... interesting in light of things that occurred after that episode aired.
Mm. Yeah, it was still relevant some 20 odd years after it was made, which is one of the good things about when Star Trek does stuff like this. And I didn't feel that Robert Foxworth was a bad guy in the first episode. I felt he was raising some valid points that they needed to address.
Yeah. Now,
whereas
In
the second one, he is the bad guy, and he's just there to get knocked over by Sisko and prove that Star Trek's utopia is wonderful and works brilliantly. Again, stepping back from the examination of, well, how, why? And that's why I think I'm a little bit more down on it and more heavy on it than we perhaps should be. Because like you say, Paul, it isn't a bad one by any stretch of the imagination. It passes the Spataro clicker test.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. But now the question I have to start off my point is, would the changelings in general be happy with the turmoil that's been created on Earth with martial law?
Yeah. The distrust?
Yeah. See, well, the thing is, do they have greater plans to do something on Earth, in which case the martial law hurts them? Or is Earth kind of insignificant to what they're doing, and therefore just creating that turmoil keeps Starfleet's attentions from being elsewhere, in which case this is good for them? You know what I mean? Because if it's the latter, and that's the way I'm going to view this, that they really don't need to do anything on Earth, that their goals are more wide-ranging. They're looking to take over the whole quadrant. They're not really worried about one, what they would probably consider insignificant planet in the grand scheme of things, and as the quadrant falls, Earth will fall as well. So, therefore, it benefits them to have Starfleet distracted and putting its manpower in a place where it doesn't really impact them, and that's why they only have four changelings on Earth. That's the way I'm viewing this. In which case, in the previous episode, when the changeling impersonated Leighton, they may have done so knowingly to help his scheme to get martial law, put into effect. You get what I'm saying? Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Because otherwise, you know, if they have grander plans for Earth, which I don't think is borne out by the fact that they only have four people there, so I don't think they have grander plans. But if they did have grander plans,
well, maybe they already,
then martial law would hurt them.
Maybe they all already knew about it, Leighton's plans, and were just helping it along just to cause a little chaos, and they don't care either way, because look how easy Odo got Sisko out of quote-unquote prison.
Hmm.
Well, that's what I'm thinking, that it actually benefits them.
I think for them, any chaos is good chaos.
Whether chaos among their enemies.
Yes. Whether they help them. So I don't think Earth being under martial law will really affect to how they can move about. I mean, it might a little bit, but, you know. I mean, Starfleet faked the changeling test, you know, to show that Sisko was the, the changeling.
I'm viewing it as that Leighton was actually kind of like a puppet of the Dominion.
You know, I was kind of wondering...
Unknowingly, with good intentions, but that he was actually doing what they wanted to. He fell into their trap.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't like that when they faked the changeling test, It's just like, how did you do that? Oh, it was not so hard. It's like, well, you know, that doesn't help us. Give me some bullshit scientific reason how you did that.
Bullshit.
So it was the commandant. So.
Dun, 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 dun.
Der Commandant. So the commandant of Starfleet Starfleet Academy isn't on this too, or, you know, so did he get canned, or did he not know what Leighton was doing with Red Squad? That's the bowling guy they called at the beginning.
Yeah.
When he's like, "Is this a secure line? Oh, thanks for finding those records. You got to erase them immediately."
My impression was that he is in on it, and he should have been forced out of his position as well.
Well, I think, again, he's a commandant of Starfleet, and he doesn't question. He just assumes that Sisko is in on Leighton's plan. Who trains these guys in military protocol? I'm pulling
Sisko
my hair
winked.
Out, going, I'm like, what are you guys? Is this a secure line? Oh, my God, I'm so glad you found that highly secret record that can't be solved. Oh, my God. Please erase that.
Sisko winked at him. He thought he was one of them.
Damn job. You're an idiot.
You should be out cutting hair.
Well, I was just going to say, with bullies mods. Should only be barbers. You moron.
Well, ever since he got fired from his position as manager of one of the Bolian baseball team, because people always figured out his strategy too early. All right, we're sending every Bolian up to bunt.
I don't mean to be so... I don't know. Things... Sometimes when I see some of the military stuff in Star Trek, I just get, you know, Bill was enraged and ripped a little Starfleet cadet's lungs out. You know, I just don't know what to do. I'm just like, that's not how that really works. I become Sisko. That's not the way it goes.
That is my favorite of your new impressions.
I'll just start talking like that
when you lose your temper.
Yeah, this is how the fire alarm works.
It's funny though how, like, when you start pulling at a little string of logic, that a lot of things start falling apart. And you would think they would have more attention to that in the writing room.
Mm.
That somebody would be saying, "Well, does that make sense?" You know, and I am very often guilty of not paying attention to such things. You know, as I'm watching it, I just accept, yeah, you know, of course he's talking to Sisko. It's Sisko. But you point that out, and it's like, yeah, why would he tell him that? He should have just kind of kept his mouth shut and then erased the record without Sisko even knowing that he did, instead of raising suspicion in Sisko.
See, the thing with this is, well, Ron D. Moore, who wrote this, was in the military. So you'd think he'd know stuff like this.
He was cleaning latrines.
I don't know. I just felt that they got themselves into a corner with this one, that they were asking questions they didn't really want to answer about the way Star Trek portrays its future, really. And I think there's a reason that Roddenberry stayed away from Earth in the original show. And this is probably it.
Yeah, I would tend to agree with that thought. But just the same, I think, you know, if you open the can of worms, you need to look inside.
Yeah, you've got to follow through. And they don't in this episode. They don't follow it up at all. Unless, I'm trying to remember if they bring back this plot as we get more serialized as we go into season 5, but I can't remember if they do or not.
Well, I still think they needed to pay lip service to it, at least. You know, I think you could have just thrown, like, a short little one-minute conversation in there after all this was revealed with the president, who, you know, is clearly kind of wishy-washy to begin with.
Yeah.
Saying, this creates an even bigger problem for me now, because now what do I do? And you just leave it at that, and okay, now you've addressed it, at least. You've let it be known that this is an ongoing thing and that it is an ongoing problem. Instead, it's just like, you know, let's all go back to the Defiant and we'll pat ourselves on the back, and, you know, you could put the closing music on.
Mm.
Yeah, but Layton had some big plans because they also mentioned how he's transferring a lot of his former officers into key positions and transferring people away. He was getting ready to make a big move.
Well, I think his ultimate goal was to be president himself.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because was this not a military coup?
Yeah.
And that was something that was a little bit more subtle in the episode, was that the president was somewhat unprepared to deal with this crisis. I think they made that clear. And that Layton probably wanted to go to a much, much more militaristic response. I mean, I think that's clear as well. But I think ultimately he wanted to get himself in that position of power to ultimately be the president.
Mm.
And almost with that Dr. Doom type thought process of not of, oh, I want to do it because of my ego or anything. I want to do it just because I think I'm the best man for the job. And this is the way to get there. And otherwise Earth won't be protected. You know, that kind of thing.
Execute Order 1701.
So, but you know, again, overall, an enjoyable episode.
Hmm.
So,
but what I have to wonder is,
what would Blaine say?
Blaine says, party time, Canadian.
What would Blaine say, Bill?
I don't know. I don't have the email open. I don't have any emails open because I suck and I can't remember the login.
You do suck and you can't remember the login. Well, let's see.
I can't remember Kenny logins either.
He's in the danger zone. Blaine would say, hi guys, here's the payoff. I don't know if this story about trading security for freedom was meant to be this topical when it aired in 1996, but it sure is topical now. The Sisko family dynamic makes for a great examination of society as a whole. We see the way Sisko operates in a crisis, and we get a very different kind of enemy, as spelled out by the O'Brien changeling. If anything, I'd have preferred that conversation to be a little more subtle. This is a great example of the quality of writing of the series, allowing for conflict within Starfleet while conforming to Roddenberry's mandates about motivations and altruism within the Federation. This has to be one of the most intense endings in the history of Star Trek, and Sisko's forethought and planning are on good display. We also get a good sense of the general humanity in this era as the Lakota backs down. I wonder if Chris Nolan watched this before co-plotting The Dark Knight. Well worth watching, Blaine. I think Blaine ranks it a little higher than we do, and that's always okay.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he clearly does not see it as problematic, and I guess as he views it, he sees those issues and those subtleties as continuing on, which I do think they do. I just don't think the episode addressed it. Overall, the O'Brien scene, I enjoyed the O'Brien scene because my biggest part about that was Colm Meaney acted as if he was not playing the same character.
Yeah,
right.
And it was clear. You know, his mannerisms were different. His facial expressions were different. And I think that's not easy to do. I think, you know, if you're just in a movie and you have a few scenes and they ask you, okay, play this scene differently than that one, I think that's really not quite that challenging. But when you play a character over and over and over again, I think you kind of use up your, you know, a lot of your range because you're doing, you know, different emotions and different things. So then to turn it around so that you actually seem like a different person is not so easy. And I kind of picture in my mind Liberace on Batman.
Hmm.
When he had to be the bad guy and he was like, "Arr!" You know? I mean, that's probably the worst example of it, and it's you know, intentional, I believe. But you know, I think that's, you know, an example of how it's not necessarily easy to be subtle sometimes.
You know, I think he should have done, he should have done Dick Van Dyke from Mary Poppins. Hello, Sisko. But changelings everywhere.
And then he just gets up and starts singing and dancing.
He turns into the one-man band. All right, that was bad. Sorry. Enough jokes at Andy's expense. Sorry.
At Andy's people.
I am not sorry, eh?
Is that hashtags? Are you going to do a tragic pop song about it, like Taylor Swift does?
Hmm? What?
Are you going to burn all your enemies in your music video?
Oh. She does that? Oh, I'm not up on Taylor Swift videos.
I know she had a controversial video out, but I didn't pay any more attention to it than that.
I think she's quite funny.
I know she's good looking.
So. Yeah, she's got the cool dead eyes of a shark, though, hasn't she?
Like Pam Dauber?
Yeah, she's trouble looking at those eyes.
Got dead eyes.
Like a shark.
So I guess it's time to rate the episode. And I go first. It's my episode. I think we were a little harsh on it. I think we're talking about it as if it's a bad episode, and it's not. It was an enjoyable episode. I just think it could have gone from being an enjoyable episode to a really, really good episode. That's what we're looking at here, I think. So I think almost by definition to me, it's a 3.0. It's solid, it's enjoyable, it's worth watching, but didn't hit the upper level that it could have.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, yeah, I agree with that. I don't think it is as bad as we've made it out to be. We have kind of accentuated the negative, but that's largely because...
There you go. The negative. Okay, I'm sorry.
No, that's fine. I think it's more that I am disappointed that part one did raise a lot of interesting topics and part two didn't really follow through in any real significant way. So that kind of impacted. But it is a three. It's not a bad one. It's an enjoyable enough episode in and of itself.
I think three vials of fake changeling blood will be my rating. But I was trying to think, like, what, you know, because sometimes we come up with ways to, what would we do to change it? And
I would add more political discussions in there and try and raise the points of, hey, what would you do in this situation, and show how it's a no-win situation.
Yeah, I think it needs a page one rewrite to not make Robert Foxworthy the bad guy, to actually focus a little bit more on his point and explain why he believes what he's doing is the right thing to do.
Like, maybe find out that actually it was, like, maybe he was influenced by the Founders in some way, maybe that he was actually a changeling all along.
No, see, I don't
you don't
want
think that,
that, honestly.
No.
No offense to your thoughts, Bill, but I don't want that, because I don't want, you know, as Andy said, I don't want him to be the mustache-twirling villain of the episode. I don't want him to be clearly wrong.
And you don't want him to be a patsy either.
No. I want it to be that right. You sit there and you say, okay, I know what he did, and I think it's wrong, but I totally understand why he did it, and it makes sense, and does the ends justify the means? That's what the question I want to walk away with.
Yeah.
In this one, they made it, no, it doesn't, he's way overreacting, and his point is wrong. That's the way that it was presented, and I think it should have been presented from a point of view of, no, the president is in a real dilemma, because what Leighton is saying is correct, but he may not be handling it the right way. You know, that kind of thing. I think you want to walk away with it being much more ambiguous as to whether or not what he was doing was right or not.
Yeah. I want it to be a private little war. I want it to be the ending of that episode where Kirk actually says, I don't know that we did the right thing here, Bones. I wanted that from it. I want Robert Foxworthy's character. I want his point to be valid. I want him to be Ra's al Ghul. There are any number of Batman Ra's stories or Ra's stories where you can actually understand what Ra's is doing and why he's doing it, but you're still on Batman's side to stop him, because ultimately he's talking about genocide. And I wanted that. I wanted a more subtle level of approach to his character. I didn't want to feel he was the bad guy for Sisko to knock down. I wanted Sisko to actually really question whether or not he was doing the right thing by doing what he was doing. I wanted more political intrigue with those two characters, and I don't think it was written well enough for Robert Foxworthy to be able to do anything with it, and I don't think he gave a subtle or nuanced enough performance to do anything with it.
Whereas the criticism that they gave themselves was their budget was too low. I don't think the special effects were the problem with this episode.
No, it's not. It's the problem is the writing of Foxworthy's character, and by extension, Sisko. He does become, Bill's impression is spot on. He becomes that kind of hyperventilating moron that he does occasionally, instead of being the subtle, thoughtful commander that I felt this script needed. I wanted both men to be absolutely right in their convictions, but ultimately the audience has to come down on Sisko's side. But I really wanted Sisko to be tormented as to the decision that he was making, because he was going against not just a commanding officer, but a man he respected.
Exactly. I agree with you 100%. And I think in part one of this, he was presented that way, Layden. I think he was, you know, somebody who you say, okay, I understand what he's getting at, and I think he's right. I mean, when they instituted martial law, you know, my thought process was, it's horrible, but what choice do they have? Mm. You know, I mean, so I think the first episode did kind of present you with that dilemma of where do you go and how far is too far. This episode said, no, it's okay. You don't need any military presence at all. Just let the changelings run around. Look at them, little O'Brien changelings. Look at them. Look at them. Let me throw them a piece of ham. You know, that's my criticism of the episode. That said, still very enjoyable to watch.
Yes.
I don't hate the show.
Yeah, because when I watched these the first time a few weeks ago, I just rolled right into the next one. You know, it's like, oh, keep going. So I didn't really notice the change, haha, snicker, as much, whereas watching it standalone, separated from the other one by a few, you know, by like about a week or two, and it is kind of drastic the way it sticks out.
Like a sore thumb.
Yes. Do you have any email? Any other email?
We have two pieces of email. But as you are aware, this was my episode, so you know what's in my contract.
Andy?
And oh, it's time all
for
right.
You to read the email, Andy.
It's time for me to earn my pay. Whatever pay that may be.
You got to do something to keep that house and the yacht and stuff.
The yacht?
My name is Andrew Leyland. I own a mansion and a yacht. Again!
Oh, dear. Christopher Golk. Again, are we pronouncing that right? I don't know that we are, but I apologize if we don't. Has maybe emailed in.
I don't know. Maybe Christopher should let us know how to pronounce it in his next email.
Maybe he's Cardassian.
Greetings, Paul and Andy. Bill's apparently relevant to this email.
Captain Dunsel, that's me.
Well, season two, so it's pre-Bill's regular status, I believe.
Right. I'm catching up with the podcast back at episode 43, season 2, episode 24. The Collaborator. I'm grateful you guys are continuing on with Deep Space Nine. The readings from the Trek Bible and comparing the entries to the end results is fascinating. I thought Crossfire... This is for next week's episode, isn't it?
Crossfire is the next one.
Yeah, we've not done Crossfire yet.
Okay, so then let's leave that one.
Let's table that.
And yeah, let's and I'll edit that back. And
oh no, hold on. Have a read of it. Is he talking about the Collaborator or is he talking about Crossfire? I'm confused.
Well, you said Collaborator, then you said Crossfire.
Well, yeah, well that's what he's written. But the title is Crossfire.
It's going to be a simple episode on the station, so we're a bit alone. Coming off a pair of episodes, Homefront and Paradise Lost. Yeah,
we haven't watched this episode yet.
So let's save this email for the next episode.
All right, and we'll go to John Joyner's email.
Okay, so but let's bring it in cleanly so that I could edit out that.
All right, okay.
Little snafu we had.
Okay. Our email tonight is thanks for the swelling. By John Joyner, who has emailed into the show before. Hello, John. Dear sirs, I just heard your podcast where you read and discuss my email. My wife did a very good job of humouring me while I raved about how you talked and gave some serious thoughts to my idea about a British-India DS9 connection. But I was on cloud nine for several days. It was nice that one of my favourite and most looked forward to podcasts in my queue took the time to hear my ravings on two of my favourite subjects. I have a few extra thoughts on it. As for your thoughts...
All right, John. You know, enough, all right? We humored you, man.
As for your thoughts on Britain being the Cardassia, I was more thinking of Britain, the Federation. Of course, my Anglophilia may be showing through, or at least how the British thought of it, helping the natives in this new and frontier world till it can join the Commonwealth as a productive member of mostly equal nations. I always thought of the Cardassian Empire more like the Mughal Empire, which was in decline at the time of the British expansion. Number two, although given Andy's comments, I did some figuring, and about the time I sent that email, we had a new member join our local stay-at-home dad's play group. He says he's from some town called Peterborough in England. I will admit, he talks like Andy. By that, you mean he talks with a British accent, because Peterborough's down south, dude. We don't deal with the south unless we have to.
And he's in the north.
And they're South English people.
Yeah,
and
he's up, the king.
And he's
king
up
of
there.
The north.
And he's up there on the wall, guarding your ass every day.
Doing all the hard
like
work.
An English Yankee.
While you all just trill around, la-di-da, drinking your tea, passing laws, as if you know what it means to be a hard working north. No, you don't know nothing. But anyway.
I rant.
His little girl has become good friends with my son, but is constantly getting him into trouble. Coincidence, maybe? No, I think that's just what little British girls do. They get Americans into trouble all the time.
Is John American?
I presume so. I could be wrong.
See, I thought John was British. His knowledge of British history, I thought, made him British.
Well, he does. He doesn't say. He does say that it's impossible. Where are you from, John? Tell us.
And is his stay-at-home dad group online? In which case, how is this guy's
I presume it's a play group. Yeah, I presume it's a regular play group.
I'm assuming the guy, unless the guy hails from Peterborough, England, and came to the United States as you know everyone wants to.
All possible.
Who knows? Okay.
Yeah, I like the idea that the girl is the one getting him into trouble. Because
girls always get into trouble. It's a lesson for your son to learn early and to never forget.
Yes, learn that lesson. Number three, another to add to the list of British India DS9, all this started with the Next Generation, is that Ferengi is a corruption of the South Indian word for foreigner, which was later used to refer to all European traders. I've been doubling upon your podcast to the detriment of some of my other less exciting podcasts. I'm only about 10 behind. Yay! Please keep up the good work, Johnny Joyner. Well, we'll try. You know? I mean, we may do an episode one that's just crap, just to see. Just to compare.
I mean, I think we've kept the bar low enough to continue to get the quality that we need on a consistent basis.
Our aspirations of mediocrity are what keep us going.
Well, I'm here just to bring everything down a little bit, so that's my job.
I'm a kid, that's my job.
I'm the Chris Farley of the podcast.
I don't know enough about British history to know John's, the validity of all his claims, but it certainly sounds like it's on the money.
Yeah.
And it sounds like it really influenced them when they were planning out this show.
Yeah, I think they have paid attention to various historical precedents when they're setting up Deep Space Nine. I think that's fair to say.
And I think he hit on enough significant points that it cannot just be coincidence.
Mm.
If it was coincidence, that would be amazing.
Mm.
Okay, that's our email. And are we going to do a book synopsis?
Yeah. Yep. I've got chapter 8. I did some reading last night, and I've been skimming through it here a little bit. Basically, in chapter 8 of A Stitch in Time.
Stitch in Time.
Thank you. I had to remember. A Stitch in 9. Stitch in 9. Deep Space Nine, A Stitch in Time.
Stitch in Time will save nine, especially with the needle fine. La ding ding, la da da, la di di da da.
Written by Andrew J. Robinson. When we get to chapter 8, basically this covers, it does a breakdown of each of the members in his group. At the Bomaran Institute, explains like the little cliques that are formed. I won't go into detail on each one. That way, you know, you guys can read, you can follow along at home and read in your books that you all went out and ran and bought at like $40 a piece if you bought the hardcover, because I guess the paperback, for what it's going for. But basically, they also discussed one of the exercises that they would do, to where they would either hunt as a group, or they would drop off individuals to evade capture. And Garrick talks about how the first time he was one of the people that had to be captured, he was so miserable when he was out trying to evade capture that he feels that he kind of allowed himself to be captured just to get it over with, and he was basically ridiculed for that. And he's really having a hard time dealing with everything. And while he's in the pit, which is the area where they do some of the physical training on site at the Institute, he kind of has another one of his, like, a breakdown, but he's overhearing a female voice, and he actually meets another female, I guess, trainee at the Institute, and I'm trying to find her name because I don't want to miss, I want to say Padeline? Pandeline? Where is her name? I'm so well prepared, as always. Palindine, that's what it was. And he's very freaked out because he's not supposed to interact with females, and the other rule is you're not supposed to give your real name to other people. So she gives her name to him, and he gives his, and then she also tells him the secret of maintaining yourself here in the Institute is to have a sense of humor. And then he's relieved by this, but then when she finally leaves him, he gets kind of indignant, and, oh, she broke the rules, she talked to me, that could get us in trouble, the uses of our names is a serious transgression, this shouldn't be happening. But in the end, he's like, he says, as I walked off, I considered telling someone about this encounter, but how would they interpret my part in it? And what about the secrecy agreement I had made with Palindine? I didn't know what to do, but I did feel much better. So that's just a quick coverage. It's a few pages long. Do you guys read it? Paul?
Maybe.
Maybe. I take that as a no.
I don't know why you think such things of me. Maybe I depend on you to do my reading for me.
Well, you're seriously lacking. See, Andy just maintained silence. You just let out the guilty, maybe.
See, the thing is, I don't have it with me. It sounded vaguely familiar, but I don't want to say I did read the chapter 2 weeks ago, the last time we did this, and then have to go, actually, no, I didn't read that. But it sounds familiar.
Yeah, what Andy said.
Yeah, it just talks about, like, how in their own, they're all the Lubbocks, and how they're all numbered 1 through 10, and how their numbers don't really indicate completely their status in the group, that it was somewhat random, and that they're forming little cliques. They're forming cliques within their group by their own classes of what they were, their societal classes. That's even still, even they're supposed to function as a unit, they're still having little offshoot ones, and how one guy can kind of go between the two or three cliques that are forming. So it's a little, interesting, but I didn't think we needed to go in full detail about that. Or else we would just read the book page by page.
It's a sad commentary on the episode that my thought was, as you were doing it, in my mind I was going, sweet Palindine, bum, bum, bum. Cardassia never looked so good, so good, so good.
Now, I haven't read, I'm getting close to the spot where I stopped reading, so I don't know if something happens later on, with her, so we will all get to that together. Eventually, maybe.
We're all in this together.
Wait, isn't that like High School Musical?
Yeah.
Well, all three of us have teenage daughters who would have been at the appropriate age to watch that when it was on. We all have an excuse for knowing that song.
We weren't watching High School Musical 3 at the cinema, dude.
That I did not do. You have no excuse for that.
Yeah, I do. My daughter wanted to see it.
I don't care how lovely Anya is. That's the one where you send your wife and you say, okay, I'll see you two when you get home.
No, I don't mind sitting through the High School Musical movies.
Well, yeah, because what? Ashley Tisdale was probably like 24 when she made that, right?
Well, that's not really what I was thinking, but okay, if that's what you want to go with it.
Whoops, I said too much.
He's a dirty Bill.
They were better than the Twilight movies.
Those I didn't see. I've never seen them. I probably never will.
Oh, you will if we do. Is it just about them?
Oof. That's you couldn't find a bigger if than that.
Anyway, next time on an all-new episode of Listen to the Prophets, it's a Kira Odo episode where he professes his love for her. Can't wait. Crossfire.
An unspoken passion.
You really are in love.
An unexpected rival.
So good looking.
Grace.
Thrown into the crossfire of danger, desire, and jealousy.
I'm falling in love with her. You've either got to tell her how you feel or forget about her.
Will Odo be forced to commit an unspeakable betrayal? On the next Star Trek Deep Space Nine.
Hey, you know, I wonder if Sisko went into Quark's and he gave him the wrong coffee, if it would sound like this. Quark, I'd like a Rattigino. Here you go.
Quark, this is not Rattigino. This is cappuccino.
And there go the Listen to the Prophets credits right now.
Wasn't as good in my head. It was much better in my head than when I did the execution.
Okay, when you said it wasn't as good in my head, I was thinking, and you still felt the need to say it.
Feel free to cut that out if you don't think it works. So.
Oh, no, it's in.
Oh, crap.
Listen to the Prophets at Deep Space Nine podcast is a Two True Freaks presentation. It is hosted by Andrew Leyland and Paul Spataro. The music and sound clips used in the show are copyright CBS and Paramount Entertainment. If you like to buy stuff from Amazon, and who doesn't, why not drop by the twotruefreaks.com website, where if you click the little link that we have there, it will take you straight through that site, and whilst it won't cost you any extra, we'll put a few shekels in our tip jar, which helps create content like this. We very much hope you enjoyed listening to The Prophets. Every episode is dedicated to the memory of our pal, Sean Engel.
Let me see if he's even awake. That's, sometimes I gotta text him, because otherwise he's sleeping. I don't know how much noise the text message makes, but apparently that's enough to wake him.
Maybe he's a light sleeper.
I don't know. You know, when we've slept in the same building, it's been there's been a good distance separating us. But I get the impression that he's, you know, that he turns into a hibernating bear. But. So I texted Phil. I said, "You there?" He responded, "Mess adequately." I don't know what that means. Then it says, it's NEEDBGEW. I don't know what that means. Then it said, "Need few," and then another text, "Minutes." So, I must have woken him.
Well, he's got one to Facebook, says, "Just waking up, slept terrible."
I can't imagine he ever sleeps well.
No.
I mean, he's Bill. No.
Yeah. He stays up all night binge-watching Supernatural. That's not good for him.